An umbrella in your hand, you stand by the gunwale, waiting to step ashore. You begin thoroughly to like it. So I set my face against a sea trip. Not, as I explained, upon my own account. I was never queer, but I was afraid for George. George said he should be all right, and would rather like it, but he would advise Harris and me not to think of it, and he felt sure we should both be ill. Harris said that, to himself, it was always a mystery how people managed to get sick at sea. Said he thought people must do it on purpose, from affectation. Said he had often wished to be, but had never been able. Then he told us anecdotes of how he had gone across the channel when it was so rough that the passengers had to be tied into their berths, and he and the captain were the only two living souls on board who were not ill. Sometimes it was he and the second mate who were not ill, but it was generally he and the one other man. If not he and another man, then it was he by himself. George said, "Well, let's go upriver." He said we should have fresh air, exercise, and quiet. The constant change of scene would occupy our minds, including what there was of Harris's, and the hard work would give us a good appetite and make us sleep well. Harris said he didn't think George ought to do anything that would have a tendency to make him sleepier than he always was, as it might be dangerous. He said he didn't very well understand how George was going to sleep any more than he did now, seeing that there were only 24 hours in a day, summer and winter alike, but thought that if he did sleep any more, he might just as well be dead, and so save his board and lodging. Harris said, however, that the river would suit him to a T. I don't know what a tea is, except a six-me one, which includes bread and butter and cake ad lib, and is cheap at the price if you haven't had any dinner. It seems to suit everybody, however, which is greatly to its credit. It suited me to a tea, too, and Harris and I both said it was a good idea of George's, and we said in a tone that seemed to somehow imply that we were surprised that George should have come out so sensible. The only one who was not struck with the suggestion was Montmorency. He never did care for the river, did Montmorency.
"Yeah, it's all very well for you fellows," he says. "You like it, I don't. There's nothing for me to do. Scenery's not in my line and I don't smoke. If I see a rat, you won't stop. And if I go to sleep, you get fooling about with the boat and slop me overboard. If you ask me, I call the whole thing bally foolishness."
We were 3-1, however, and the motion was carried. Chapter 2. We pulled out the maps and discussed plans. We arranged to start on the following Saturday from Kingston. Harris and I would go down in the morning and take the boat up to Chertsey, and George, who would not be able to get away from the city till the afternoon, George goes to sleep at a bank from 10 to 4 each day, except Saturdays, when they wake him up and put him outside at 2, would meet us there. Should we camp out or sleep at inns? George and I were camping out. We said it would be so wild and free, so patriarchal-like. Harris said,
How about when it rained?
You can never rouse Harris. There is no poetry about Harris. No wild yearning for the unattainable. Harris never weeps. He knows not why. If Harris's eyes fill with tears, you can bet it is because Harris has been eating raw onions or has put too much Worcester over his chop. If we were to stand at night by the seashore with Harris and say, "Hark! Do you not hear? Is it but the mermaids singing deep below the waving waters? Or sad spirits chanting dirges for white corpses held by seaweed?" Harris would take you by the arm and say,
"I know what it is, old man. You've got a chill. Now, come along with me. I know a place round the corner here where you can get a drop of the finest Scotch whisky you ever tasted. Put you right in less than no time."
Harris always does know a place round the corner where you can get something brilliant in the drinking line. I believe that if you met Harris up in Paradise, supposing such a thing likely, he would immediately greet you with,
"Oh, so glad you've come, old fellow. I found a nice place round the corner here where you can get some really first-class nectar."
In the present instance, however, as regarded the camping out, his practical view of the matter came as a very timely hint. Camping out in rainy weather is not pleasant. We, therefore, decided that we would sleep out on fine nights, and hotel it, and inn it, and pub it, like respectable folks, when it was wet, or when we felt inclined for a change. Montmorency held this compromise with much approval. He does not revel in romantic solitude. Give him something noisy, and if a trifle low, so much the jollier. To look at Montmorency, you would imagine that he was an angel sent upon the earth, for some reason withheld from mankind, in the shape of a small fox terrier. There is a sort of, "Oh, what a wicked world this is, and how I wish I could